Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Tell me what you see, it's the Donut Dynasty. Nah, pop the hood, tell me what you see. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Yeah, pop the hood, tell me what you see. Tell me what you see, it's the Dynasty.
Diagnostic, popped it, now your team is the topic. Eitan and Stompy as a team, they're unstoppable. All bold, but no bold, it is roll in a roll that I'm told. Come a bowl to a cockpit. And I just hope there's no leaks, yeah. I ain't changed my oil in weeks, yeah. How'd I get a lot of these stains on my seats, yeah. Only mechanics that I trust cause it's free, yeah. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. It's my dynasty team and it's got a couple needs. Is it this, is it that, is it picks, is it bad? Do I even have a chance, do I got it in the bag? Let me know.
Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Tell me what you see, it's the Dynasty. Nah, pop the hood, tell me what you see. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Yeah, pop the hood, tell me what you see. Tell me what you see, it's the Dynasty.
Diagnostic, Gnostic, Gnostic.
Thanks for listening to the Dynasty Diagnostic Podcast. Tune in every week for a thorough inspection of the Dynasty landscape to learn how recent news affects your roster and to gather strategic tips and tricks to give your squad that turbocharged boost it needs. Please welcome your head technicians, Eitan Mosia and Sam Lane.
What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to the shop. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the Dynasty Diagnostic Podcast, part of the Dynasty Trade Calculator family of podcasts. My name is Eitan Mosia. I'm joined by Sam Lane. You can find me on Twitter at EitanAlive. Go ahead and follow Sam at FFSnompy. And today, we've been fortunate enough to have a friend of the show back for round two, formerly of PFF and still one of the most insightful minds in the fantasy landscape. Please join me in welcoming Scott Barrett.
Thank you, guys. That was a very beautiful and lovely introduction. Thank you for that.
I swear I'm going to start putting those like royal horns as he's speaking just underneath him, because he just loves to toot everybody's horn and announce their presence in this like grand gesture.
Hey man, we have like the whole live thing going on right now. So, I mean, we should go 100 with it, like have the full like path of trumpets laid out, yeah. Have the red carpet virtually laid out, man. Let's do this. I'm ready.
I just imagine like a scroll unraveling to the floor.
Yeah.
Hear ye, hear ye.
That's exactly. That's the one. But guys, ladies and gentlemen out there, if you are not following Scott, you are not doing fantasy football right. Go ahead and follow him on Twitter at Scott Barrett DFB. I think that's formerly Dude Fantasy Bro. I wanted to ask you the actual story behind that name. Was there like a, like, how did you come up with that?
Yeah, that was like 6 years ago, I want to say. Whenever Masahiro Tanaka was a rookie, because that was the first fantasy article I did for NumberFire, JJ Zacharyson was my boss. He was like, bro, you got to get on Twitter. What are you doing? And so I was at the bar. I was talking to my buddy John, who's just like this wild character. And I was talking to the bartender, who's also one of my friends who just obsessed with fantasy. He's in all the high stakes leagues, joined to all the sites. Great guy. And couldn't come up with a name and whatever. We just pivot back to our conversation about fantasy. And my buddy John at this point is just hammered. And he's annoyed that he can't get his drink because we're too busy talking about fantasy. Just goes, dude, fantasy, bro. No one cares. And I just like that. So, dude, fantasy, bro.
It's perfect, man. That's perfect. That's,
you gotta love the origin story. It's just like
the funny thing though is like I reveled in obscurity for like 2.5-3 years. You know, on Twitter I had, you know, 80 followers. That was it. No one read my articles. And then as soon as I changed my handle from Dude Fantasy Bro to Scott Barrett DFB, just overnight just got 3,000 followers. People, no one wants to follow a dude fantasy, bro. So I don't know. That gave me credibility or something. DFB, real ones know what it stands for.
Hey, man, I will follow dude fantasy, bro, to the ends of this earth. Just you watch me. But we are now going to get into the first portion of our show here. And we actually kind of just had a little bit of a conversation about part of it here. 2007, that is when Masahiro Tanaka was a rookie. If that was your first article, that is 13 years ago today. You've been doing this for 13 years. What has changed?
That's not right. Time? He was a rookie in the Japanese league, I think. Hold on.
Okay. See, now I totally messed it up.
That'd be insane. 2014, so 6 years ago.
Okay. Again, still, I mean, a lot of things change from year to year. Like, what do you think has been the biggest shift in the fantasy landscape over the last 5-6 years or so?
Yeah, I mean, everything in the industry has gotten better. There's better analysts, better projections, better analysis, better rankings, more information, more readily accessible information, better quality. And as a result, you know, fantasy leagues have gotten tougher. DFS has gotten extremely tough.
So that would lead right into my next question. I mean, is this, I guess, excess of information causing the fantasy community as a whole to become smarter? Or do you think that because oftentimes there's little to no understood context that is presented with that information, that maybe people are suffering from information overload and not necessarily getting the full story and citing stats that don't necessarily pertain to what they're even trying to get at?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely things have gotten better, but I mean, people have gotten smarter. Leagues have gotten tougher, but there's still an edge. I like what you said with information overload. Though, just because there's a disconnect between expert leagues and casual leagues, but the disconnect between expert leagues and casual leagues is shrinking, but there's still a sizable gap, and even like a lot of experts still have a long way to go. We have a ton of information available to us, but you know, still not a lot of people know how to analyze that. At PFF, I was lucky because I had the best stats and I just spent countless hours, you know, running correlations, trying to figure out how much these metrics actually mattered. In fact, that was one of my long-running articles. So you'll see people, you know, cite, oh, Zach Ertz had 7 drops and 2 missed tackles. Vance McDonald had 3 drops and 10 missed tackles. For tight ends, that doesn't matter at all. It matters drops, super overrated. Missed tackles matter for running backs, not really for tight ends. Or you'll see Kenyon Drake had 18 air yards and Aaron Jones had 80. Air yards for running back doesn't matter. So, you know, a lot of information, like you said, but you have to know which information is valuable. And we still have a ways to go, even though, like I said, you know, we are getting tougher. The leagues are getting tougher every year. And we're getting smarter every year.
I just don't know how to one thing that I know I need to get better at is actually doing like regression analysis, stuff like that associated. I really want to learn to kind of do programs and be more like, and I'm an engineer, so I'm pretty good with Excel, but I'm not anywhere near what you and Peter Howard and all of these stats guys are. So that's definitely something I need to get better at, but it's just like crazy how you can take numbers that are just like people understand, but then you look down deep and see how those numbers came into being and can those improve or is there going to be a negative regression, and then find that player. So I'm very appreciative of you. I know metrics matter. That was one of my favorite article series because it was like you actually dive deep into, okay, these are the stats you're missing though when you just read that one number. You need to understand air yards and ADOT and all those things. So I appreciate you guys like you who translate those tools into something that we can digest.
Yeah, I'll also say don't be too intimidated by Excel. Like, I'm a total Excel dummy. Like, I still use VLOOKUP instead of index match. And, you know, I know, like, Mike Beers, it takes him 3 seconds, but it takes me to do 5 minutes. But just, you know, a quick YouTube video, you'll figure it out soon enough.
Yeah, man, that seems to be the way of the world. Now, I guess kind of branching off of this, so obviously the fantasy community is using this information to become a little bit more informed each year. And like you said, the gap between expert leagues and, you know, regular leagues is starting to lessen year over year. But, I mean, at the end of the day, these numbers, all this information should matter most to the actual teams. Do you see evidence that NFL teams are actually starting to use some of this information in their decision-making? Would you say is the norm teams now bringing in people who have a background in this and actually taking their advice when they make decisions? Or is the norm kind of still, yeah, even if they associate themselves with people who are heavy into analytics, they still make a lot of decisions based on either gut feelings or quote unquote football guys' intuitions?
Yeah, I mean, the analytics community kind of treats NFL teams, NFL GMs, NFL owners, NFL coaches as dinosaurs who are super anti-analytical and stuck in the mud and, you know, 20 years behind. I tend to give them more credit. I think, you know, they just play coy a little bit. They don't want to give away edges. Every team has pays money for a PFF account. Every team gets next gen stats, and they have a person inside to analyze that information for them. They have, you know, full analytics departments that run numbers up to the top. I think they're a lot more analytically minded than a lot of people give them credit for.
Yeah, see, that's something that, like you stated early on, I mean, maybe people that's kind of do what you,
I mean, so look at this. We have like part of the analytics community on a daily basis is just absolutely hammering teams or beating a dead horse on the point that running backs don't matter that much. They're easily replaceable. Rushing isn't as important as passing. And it's just like a daily dead horse beating. But look at how much running backs were making 10 years ago as a percentage of salary cap, and look at how much they're making today. Look at where they're being drafted. And again, like, you know, rookies, that's a cheap contract, but really NFL has been trending in the direction that, you know, Atlantic, the analytics community has said these should be trending in for some time now.
Oh yeah. It's got to the point that Saquon Barkley, drafted as the number two pick, I think is in the top six or seven of total running back contracts in the NFL right now, just being drafted that high because of the guaranteed salary of a first round pick that high. That tells you that NFL teams aren't spending anything at the position. So yes, maybe they don't overtly say, okay, well, this is our plan, this is specifically what we're trying to do. But yeah, there's a lot of clues I think you can take to what they're actually doing based on what their moves are when it comes to the financial side of things. I think, you know, teams are really only honest when they draft players or when they spend money on players. Outside of that, everything else is kind of playing it coy so as to not give the next team down the road that extra information that you might be using to get that edge this year. So I definitely do think, and I agree with you in that they should probably be given more credit than we do. Now let's move on to just, you know, talking about some of the things that I guess are going to be unique to this year. Obviously, we usually have both the combine as well as individual pro days to go ahead and look at specific players and to find the athletic profiles that pop most to us as fantasy players and to teams themselves. With the coronavirus situation that's happening right now, pro days aren't really a thing anymore. Not that they were 100% credible in the first place, but that's just less information. I guess my question is this. Obviously, a lot relies on draft capital. Draft capital is a thing that you found and that many have found that clearly matters. If there's less information available to the teams, do we think that maybe we need to wait draft capital maybe a little bit less than we do most years this year because of them not being able to kind of get the full picture?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I could definitely see hit rate declining this year due to, you know, what's going on with the coronavirus pandemic. But at the same time, I mean, according to my data, the combine literally doesn't matter at all for wide receivers. And adjusting for draft capital, teams are probably better off not even looking at it. Really, I'm inclined to not treat anything differently. It might have a small impact on draft capital, but, you know, even so, it's going to be a combination of where I had these guys pre-draft, draft capital, landing spot, post-draft press conferences, and things of that nature. I do think the coronavirus pandemic could be more influential in another way. I think with assuming no OTAs, assuming training camp gets pushed back, that's less group practice time. That means maybe it's worth downgrading rookies, teams instilling a new playbook, offensive playbook, receivers with a new quarterback under center. You know, it's less time to establish rapport with your quarterback, less time to flash for your coaches, fully grasp the playbook, et cetera.
I just wonder, like you said, if those rookie quarterbacks, especially like Joe Burrow's probably expected to go to Cincinnati and start right away. Don't really know what's going to happen with San Diego, but if somehow they go like Justin Herbert, could very easily start week one. And how much that affects, I guess, just in terms of fantasy football, like how much worse they're going to be. So that, I mean, that's a very valid point.
I mean, just with rookies, especially rookie wide receivers, there's just such a steep learning curve, and training camp is just monumental. You've seen this so many times where, you know, a guy really struggled his rookie season and broke out his sophomore season and then was a beast from then on. You're like, well, what happened his rookie year? You know, that guy dealt with injuries in training camp. You know, that's typically such a death knell for rookies. That practice time is invaluable. But I mean, again, this is just like, am I really going to be downgrading these guys? Like, maybe to break ties. I don't think it's going to be a massive factor.
Specifically to that, before we move on to our 5-point inspection, a guy like Marquise Brown missed a lot of training camp last year due to injury, but still had a halfway decent rookie season. Would you, I guess, look on that rookie season even a brighter light than maybe you would have originally having that information?
Yeah, so he's actually one of my biggest buys of this offseason. I got heat for it, but I had him number three among the 2019 rookie wide receivers. Like, if I'm ranking them now, A.J. Brown, then Terry McLaurin, and then Metcalf four, and a lot of people didn't like that. But you just look at his numbers, like, yeah, given the fact that he was hurt in all throughout training camp, he also wasn't fully healthy at any point last season. He spent 9 of 16 games on the injury report listed as questionable. During the regular season, he played on just 58% of the snaps. During the postseason, he played on 85% of the snaps. It was one game. He turned 11 targets into 126. That's what you saw in the beginning of the season before the initial re-aggravation of the injury. And even with all of that working against him, his numbers were absurd. Of course, you know, it was one of the most efficient offenses in football, but he ranked first among all wide receivers in passer rating when targeted. He ranked 11th in fantasy points per route run. And he had draft capital to back him, which, you know, Terry McLaurin didn't have, certainly should have. He was a monster. Nor A.J. Brown, who I actually liked more than Brown pre-draft, but still, just everything you want to look at. And in startups, he is going closer to Preston Williams than McLaurin or Brown.
Yeah, I think that added context is kind of a real key into you know, figuring out, like you were saying, those small edges that you can find that help you differentiate things and break ties just a little bit. But now let's move into our 5-point inspection. Let's talk about Dynasty. We talked about football enough. Let's talk about Dynasty specifically. What is your overarching idea about team building when it comes to your Dynasty roster? For me, it's always maintaining flexibility. That's what I'm always looking at in startups all the way to the end of whatever time that I put into this particular Dynasty league. But, I mean, are you targeting a certain position to do that? Are you less focused on flexibility and more focused on trying to win as early as possible to kind of bank that rebuilding year, rebuilding years? What is your approach to building your Dynasty squad?
Yeah, is it okay if I go into this in a little more detail?
Yes, sir.
Just like working out my thought process on this, because I don't know. I tried something new this year. But basically, what am I going to do? I'm going to try and maximize every edge possible, especially, you know, hammer the biggest ones, which has been, well, I mean, it depends on the league. It depends on your opponent. It depends on the year. You know, like we said, we're getting smarter. There's better analysis, better analysts. But so I've never tanked in a dynasty league before this year. I've always been win now, which is just like, I'm just like, all right, I think I can outdraft my opponents. And then I was successful doing that, outdrafting my opponents. But I think I might be leaving money on the table. So I've been, right now I'm writing an article on how fantasy football is different than the stock market. So like everyone's written the article how it's similar, but this one's on how the key way they're different. But I'm writing that piece. I've uncovered some great Warren Buffett quotes, a better understanding of his strategy. And so he's a long-term value investor. So let's say like 50% of the stock market, they draft their, 50% of the stock market, they're buying stocks to hold for, you know, about a year. Let's say 20% is just the next quarterly earnings report. Another 10%, they're day traders. And the rest are guys like Warren Buffett, who his edge is he wants to buy stocks and hold them for 20 years. He said his favorite holding period is indefinitely. Just hold them for, just find an amazing company that you think is going to be around for a really long time. Own it for forever. So just like immediately thinking with Dynasty, that's like, okay, so running backs, you know, a lot changes year over year. Like in my startups right now, we still have the draft yet to come. You know, a lot of these guys could lose their job to a rookie, you know, a team you didn't expect. Like what if, you know, Devin Singletary, love Devin Singletary, but what if the team drafts Jonathan Taylor? So they're very fragile. In that regard, but also because, you know, the lifespan of a running back is a lot shorter, more prone to injury, a bunch of other things, right? So I do tend to devalue running backs. I want, you know, blue chips, which tend to be, you know, look at guys who you think are going to be dominant for, you know, like Patrick Mahomes is my number one player in a super flex because, you know, ideally I'm locking up a top three quarterback for 20 years. You have to assess the risk of this league folding, but I think he should be, you know, the 101 because of that. But this was a slight digression. So I think I've been leaving money on the table doing this win now strategy. This year, I've done something slightly similar. I'm pulling up Elliot Chris startup draft, which I'm in right now. And just looking at this, what we did was we didn't draft a player in the first three rounds. Between rounds 8 and 9, we drafted 7 players. And then that's it. That's it. And then by doing that, we have 8 firsts in 2021. We have 5 round 2s in 2021. And we have 2 round 1 and 2s in 2022. And I mean, that's ridiculous. You can't look like hope for anything as like sexy as that. But, I still like, even if you cut that in half, I'd feel good about it. And what happened was we went into the draft. I have a partner, TJ Calkins. Why Warren Buffett does that strategy is he doesn't want to compete against all the people who have a short-term oriented mindset, which is the far majority of people who own stocks. So his edge is by competing against people 10 years down the road. And there's far fewer of those. And that's exactly what I tried to do in this startup, because I know my opponents. It has Rich Rebar in round one, immediately, you know, win now. Evan Silva, Grant Barfield always go win now. Curtis Patrick and Elliot Chris typically go win now. So why am I going to compete against four plus teams who are doing everything they can to win in 2020? Who's trying to win in 2021, 2022? Far fewer teams, I think. So then what do? Load up on these ones and twos, which I cornered the market on the rookie draft next year, which if you want to buy my 112, you're going to have to pay your next year's round one and round two. That's an easy profit. Beyond that, I'm avoiding running backs because remember, they're so fragile, especially with the NFL draft still to come. And then I'm not competing this year. So all of next year, so not having a single running back pretty much locks me into the 101. And 2021 is a especially unique year in that, I mean, I'd feel so good about trying to bet on who I think, you know, four of the top six picks in Superflex drafts are going to be next year. Trevor Lawrence, one, Justin Fields, two, Ja'Marr Chase, three, Chubb, four. I mean, ideally, I'd get Trevor Lawrence or Fields, who I think are going to be, you know, borderline round one startup picks. So you're punting year one, but a ridiculous supply of rookie picks, and you know, a super valuable 101 guaranteed to you. I think I could be competitive as early as 2022, and then build a 5-year dynasty from then on out. But that rant lasted way too long. But I'm eager to hear your guys' thoughts.
I hate it so much because it makes sense, but I still hate it. Like the fact that it makes sense makes me hate it that much more. I think the key here is that it requires patience and dynasty players, while we're playing constantly and tweaking constantly, people aren't patient with players, with rebuilds, stuff like that. And what you're doing best and what you're doing, it sounds like, is you're basically swinging the opposite direction of the quote unquote market, where you have all of these people where the stock market's high, and you're going low. You're basically selling everything off and then swiveling back the other way. You're basically signing to their cosign, where then you start buying players that are down or cheaper, and then or you get those rookies early on, and now you're ready to compete when those guys are you're probably weeding out the competitive teams at that point. You're down to two or three instead of, like you said, six, seven, eight of the people that are trying to compete or win now. So I've done it kind of like that before on a Superflex tight end premium, where I traded back and I didn't have my first picks, I believe, until the fourth or fifth round. And I ended up winning the championship that year. So I get it. I get it in terms of, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of value later on in drafts, but the way you did it, it's hard for me to go into a startup and be like, I'll compete in 2022. And then you can compete for 3, 4, 5 years because you've got all these young players and these guys are, all of the other teams have aging players. So that's why I hate it, because I just am so competitive that rebuilds and trying to be that patient's hard for me, but I love it because it makes sense.
Yeah. So just to touch on what you were saying, Warren Buffett, back to him, he talks about, you know, warning against the comfort of the consensus all the time. He said, you know, whenever I start to get nervous, when I find a high number of people agreeing with me, that's typically when I've lost the most money. So a contrarian mindset, I think, in investing and in fantasy can be really valuable. You know, the hyped sleeper, you know, he's probably not, no longer a value. Where the guy everyone's dumping on, like let's say, outside of Dynasty, like Todd Gurley in redraft, let's say, or Melvin Gordon, especially, who I actually think is the case, is more of a value going against that. But yeah, really, it goes to competition. If I wanted to win now, I'd be competing against six other teams that have done everything in their power to make sure they're winning now. They're drafting Adam Thielen early. They sold their round one, their whatever. And then I'm competing against no one to try and win 2 years from now. But yeah, like you said, it's patience. And that's tough for a lot of people. But I really do think I'm going to have a team that wins, you know, 3 years in a row, but guaranteed to finish last this year.
And yeah, I mean, that's one of those things. And I think it's even when you're in the middle of the season, I think it's a good thing to be able to recognize when you're not going to compete. So this isn't necessarily a drafting strategy, but a strategy where you need to understand that, or you need to be objective about your team and be like, all right, I have these guys, they could all be great, but they're also huge question marks. And I don't have anybody solid, and I don't have the depth to compete with those top two or three teams. I need to sell my assets off, rebuild over a two-year period with those younger assets, and then start fresh and do it. You do it and you start winning 2-3 championships, or at least making the championship, and you know you did the right thing.
Yeah, it's important. It's important to set your own edges. It's important to find a way to differentiate yourself from the crowd, because, I mean, like you said, it's very, very difficult to compete when everyone's trying to do the same thing. So, yeah, like I was saying before, maintaining flexibility is always the number one goal of my teams, and that manifests itself, at least for me, in just drafting loads and loads of wide receivers early. I hate having to spend a first-round pick on a wide receiver, a first-round rookie pick on a wide receiver, because, I mean, there are so many – there's so many things that can happen, and there's so many opportunities for that player that I just drafted to be devalued at the same time next season that, I mean, it just completely scares me away. So what I find myself doing in startups often is going really, really heavy for young veteran wide receivers early, for the hope that, I mean, in the future, these guys are still going to have enough value to then move off a certain position if I need to, or to then, you know, attack something else that I might not necessarily be worried about that first year. I think everything you said about drafting running backs and the lack of real longevity with running backs just because of the shifting sands of the NFL and the demands of that position, just in terms of not even being injured, there are so many ways to get yourself in a situation where you're very, very strong and very competitive for a very, very short window. And then you're spending the rest, you know, 2, 3, 4 years down the line just trying to get back to zero. So I think everything that you said about making the pool that you live in a smaller one and making yourself a bigger fish in a smaller pond is probably what you need to do to be consistently competitive long-term in a dynasty league. All right, so now let's talk about your work. I mean, again, you've done all kinds of things with PFF. I know you just recently left PFF, but you're still got your nose to the grindstone. Right before this conversation, we actually we're chatting a little bit in the DMs, and you had said that, you know, the best way to make sure that you're not missing, you know, different things with different time zones, it's just be in front of your computer the whole time. And I know that you just put in a tremendous amount of time, a tremendous amount of effort, and a tremendous amount of work in the things that you do put out. And because of that, I mean, I need to ask you, has there been an overarching philosophy that you found that kind of applies to a bunch of different questions that you're trying to answer in space? Or has there been a methodology that you found that works that you've continued to apply to the different questions you asked? I know that I think earlier on you mentioned being able to not necessarily being the best at Excel, but at least having that background, at least having that ability to see the actual stats and the actual things that correlate with fantasy success over time. Is that an example of just a methodology that you've kind of laid out that allows you to kind of find answers that more closely correlate with what actually happens at the end of the year when it comes to looking at those final fantasy stats?
I don't really know how to answer this, but I just question everything. I don't take anything for granted. I don't care what everyone else is saying, what everyone else thinks. I don't care if what I'm going to say makes me seem stupid. Just, forget about the consensus, the comfort of the consensus. Just do your own thing. I think my work's unique. I think it's also gotten me in trouble is, questioning things, that maybe I should have just, blindly accepted, but I don't know.
I think this time last year, pretty much everybody on this panel here was all in on Damian Williams. We were all 100% kind of gung-ho, thinking that Damian Williams could have been one of those top five RBs. And I'm not necessarily ready to take the L on that, because I think when healthy, we saw the type of fantasy impact he could have produced. It's just, judging when or if a player is going to get injured is obviously a hard thing to predict. Was there an issue with our methodology and how we came to that conclusion, or was this just a random chance kind of fluctuation that you can't necessarily predict?
This one's a tough one. I think he's probably appropriately priced at the end of the day. Like, we know his upside. We saw it when he was healthy, but we also know that there was a high degree of injury risk. That's something I struggle with. It's one of the holes to my game, is maybe not appropriately valuing injury risk as much as I should. I don't remember when our podcast aired, but, early on, Andy Reid was, this is our guy. He's our bell cow. Let's do this thing. And then, as the offseason progressed, he kind of walked that back a little bit more and more. And then there was the LeSean McCoy signing. And then it seemed early on he was legitimately, trying to get LeSean McCoy involved in this offense. But at the same time, he was good. When he was healthy, he was amazing for fantasy. The assumption that, it doesn't really matter that he doesn't have this this pedigree. He might not even be that good. It's an Andy Reid offense. It's a Patrick Mahomes led Andy Reid offense. All those things were true, but I, at the end of the day, I think it's just, he was appropriately valued. The risks was there and we saw the risk. The upside was there and we saw the upside. And, if he stayed healthy the whole time, or he just got hurt and never played a snap, would have been the same thing.
Well, and I think one of those things, when we're talking about like writing process and stuff, or I guess argument process, it is process over product, right? I think the process was correct, especially because it was before there was any major threat to Damian Williams. And LeSean McCoy, like you said, Andy Reid had said this was our guy. We saw what Damian Williams did was the last 4 or 5 weeks of the season and into the playoffs. If you put a good process and a good argument, a good thought in it, and you can back those things up, then but if it's going against the grain or against consensus, you need to hold your head high, but you need to just hold that opinion. Don't sway. And I think that's what you were trying to get at in the first point was, listen, if you feel good about the thought and you have data to back it up, then hold on to that opinion.
I'm personally willing to double down on this stance by being very, very interested in Will Fuller this year. understanding that injury history and understanding, you know, that he may or may not play games this year. If he plays 10, I think it's a huge profit. I mean, if you look at where he's going in drafts right now compared to what his upside is, I think his upside is just way higher than anyone else, even in the same realm as him right now. When you're looking at draft boards, I think that we've seen Will Fuller healthy. Obviously, we haven't seen him without DeAndre Hopkins, but Will Fuller healthy with Deshaun Watson has been, I mean, like a Marquise Brown, like a Tyler Lockett, just extremely efficient at converting his total targets into fantasy points, whether that be by just huge amounts of yards on one catch or a touchdown or three in a given game because of his ability to gain such separation with his speed. Are you willing to make that same leap of faith again this year, kind of understanding what that might have burned us with last year with a guy like Damian Williams?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know about Will Fuller specifically. I don't know if he's, you know, necessarily the type of receiver you're going to think that the loss of DeAndre Hopkins is going to correlate into more targets and he's going to be successful with it. I might not be a true wide receiver one. Might just be more of an ancillary piece in the offense. But just with regard to injury risk, yeah, I mean, that's something I chase a lot. Just fundamentally in fantasy football, the value in a ceiling is just worth so much more than a floor. So you're really heavily rewarded to chase those high upside guys. Like you just saw last year, Christian McCaffrey, Lamar Jackson, Chris Godwin, Michael Thomas absolutely swung leagues. They helped your team way more than drafting AJ Green hurt your team. One of the most interesting stats I found since the offseason was like James White beat his ADP by like he was ADP RB 30 and he finished ADP RB 18, whatever it was.
And he still didn't help your team.
And no, his win rate was worse than average. It was ridiculous. So like it's just, you know, those middle of the pack borderline guys don't really do much for you when, you know, Christian McCaffrey, you know, 50% of Christian McCaffrey teams made it to their championship on ESPN. That's absurd. Like there was no skill. There was skill in drafting Lamar Jackson in round 10, identifying him, Stompy, take your victory lap. There was no skill in drafting Christian McCaffrey number two. So like that shirt. Yeah. So you're heavily rewarded for identifying the right high upside guys. And maybe that's Will Fuller.
It's not. I think he only has one hamstring at this point.
You said the same thing about Leonard Fournette last year, I believe. So we can replay those
things. You're not wrong.
But
imagine how many touchdowns he would have scored with two.
Right.
But I think the takeaway here is pretty clear though. It pays to be riskier than not. I mean, there's no shame in going for the ceiling and missing out on the floor, because that ceiling is going to sway leagues more than that floor ever would. And for me, I think what that means is be very clinical and be very tactical with how you build your rosters. If you understand that you have a guy that is going to be extremely volatile or has the potential to be extremely volatile, then maybe in later rounds, maybe at that point, I'm more willing to, you know, chase the James White just because, you know, he's likely to be healthy and likely to be decent for my team in the event that some high upside guy like Damian Williams doesn't necessarily fire for you. But I think that means that your most valuable picks need to be spent on chasing risk, because I think at the end of the day, if you're not chasing risk, I mean, the best that you're hoping for is maybe making the playoffs as the bottom seed and not necessarily getting the opportunity to really win leagues as much as those high upside guys would give you that opportunity. So I think it's really, really important that we keep in the back of our minds that that upside is the only goal in fantasy leagues. All right, so one of the things that we just talked about in this podcast is the possible benefit of being a long-term thinker, of having the in-the-long-run type mentality when building your teams. But this doesn't always translate to what real-life teams are doing. We see so often in sports, GMs are forced into short-term decision-making, and that dooms their team because it ladens that team with bad contracts, maybe with players that don't fit the team philosophy, maybe with players at different stages of development that aren't all peaking at the same time, which leads to a team that's a little bit more disjointed than we would like. And I guess we're seeing an example of this in the NFL right now. Word is that Dave Gettleman has been given just one more year to turn the Giants around. And I think it's not far-fetched to say the Giants probably have a bottom five, bottom eight roster, if you want to be generous, in the NFL right now. But he has one year to turn around the franchise. Is there any hope for the immediate future of this franchise with this type of thinking? And is there a better way? Are there better examples maybe you can point to in the NFL of GMs that were given the leeway to be a little bit more long-term minded?
Yeah, this is just a team that's just absolutely lost. It has no direction, just bad leadership. You saw this two years ago when they were going win now, or even last year, going win now, when it was clear they're a bottom three offense that should be, you know, trying to take a long-term orientation, you know, set themselves up as best they can for the future, because they're not going to do anything right now. They, you know, gave Pat Shurmur, let Pat Shurmur draft his guy, Daniel Jones, way earlier than anyone else expected. And guess what? He actually, you know, surprised people. He did a lot better than I anticipated. He did a lot better than most people thought. And what do? You fire Pat Shurmur, the offensive-minded head coach and play caller who's supposed to groom this guy. You bring in, a New England coach with very little experience. Special teams. He did wide receivers for a year when New England had the worst wide receiver room in football. And didn't do much with it. But yeah, what you're talking about is a recent report where Jay Glazer said the Giants ownership told Dave Gettleman he had one year to turn the team around. Just like the stupidest thing you could do is forcing on a bad bottom five NFL roster year one or two into a rebuild, making him take a short-term orientation. That's how you lead to There's a great book by a German political theorist named Hans Hoppe called Democracy, the God that Failed. And I don't know how earnestly he states this case. It might just be for effect, but he says that the United States would be better off with a constitutional monarchy rather than having a president with a direct election, two terms, 4 years apiece. Because then what you have is you have a guy with a short-term orientation. You're going to get a massive federal deficit, which he has no interest in ever paying off, because guess what? He's out of the picture by the time those checks are due. So you just have president after president just constantly kicking the curb down. We see that. We have a massive federal deficit. We're monetizing the debt right now. I mean, I don't know if we're better off with a king, but just like what he's saying, I think is applicable here, where, okay, you give Dave Gettleman a short-term orientation. You have one year to turn this team around. What's he going to do? He's going to sacrifice the future to save his job for today. He's going to take on, you know, contracts that are going to burden this team 2 years down the road. They're in a hole and they're just digging it deeper. He's going to draft, you know, let's say there's two different players, one who he think could be an all-star in 3 years, but you're going to have to build that up, or a guy who's going to be an average starter today through the rest of his career. He's going to draft the guy who helps the team today, and you just can't have that. And I just think that's a big mistake. And again, you know, I don't know what the Giants are. I'm a Giants season ticket holder. You know, I live in Houston, but it breaks my heart. They're just dummies. Not as bad as the Jets. Never as bad as the Jets. But they're
Jesus dummies. Christ, the Jets.
You never go full gaze. You can never go full gaze.
So I think the opposite to me is the Miami Dolphins, right? I mean, they gave Brian Flores a 5-year contract. And they're going into full rebuild. They're not taking, I mean, shit, their rebuild started this offseason because they didn't take on like burdened contracts. They made some signings and still have a ton of cap space next season to continue that rebuild. And that's when you get, I'm just wondering if they go Tua, if it comes up, or if they're going to try and get that first pick overall again. Regardless, you've made some signings this offseason, have a bunch of cap space next season. Flores and I don't know the GM there. Regardless, they have some time to build this team into a contender, and they've started already because they didn't spend a stupid amount of money on like a quarterback last season. They got Ryan Fitzpatrick for pretty cheap. So, I think those are two very good, very different philosophies going into the 2020 season.
I mean, you saw the dynasty teams I'm drafting this year. And again, I've never done it before this year. Maybe it's stupid, but I would do the same thing if I were the New England Patriots. I mean, genius mastermind who tries to maximize every edge he can, skate the NFL rulebook. I could totally see him tanking outright for Trevor Lawrence. And I would do the same thing if I were Carolina Panthers. You know, 1 year into a rebuild, Luke Kuechly's gone, Cam Newton's gone, Greg Olsen's gone. I wouldn't have even signed Teddy Bridgewater. I would have signed Colin Kaepernick to bring a bunch of fans into the seats. I would have signed Tim Tebow to bring in all the Christians. You know, so you got people in the seats. People are happy, and both of them are terrible. So you're going to finish in last place, and then you're going to get Trevor Lawrence or Justin Fields, probably the two best quarterback prospects since Andrew Luck. I mean, we've heard that said a year early before, but I mean, I think both of those guys are special, and you're better off doing that than, I don't know, Teddy Bridgewater. I like Teddy Bridgewater, but I mean, this isn't a team that's competitive this year. Yeah, so you're not going to make the playoffs. Yeah,
I think it's just funny the parallels between like dynasty, and I'm not saying like dynasty players could be GMs in the NFL. Don't put words in my mouth, listeners. Eitan, nobody. but when you look at it, I just don't know how it feels like some GMs are always in win now mode, and they're doing anything they can to win and not looking at it objectively. Signing
it's
a
job, quarter- again, it's so, job preservation. That's why you see the best NFL franchises. It used to be the Giants. No, it's not any longer, but the best NFL franchises have that GM and with amazing job security, like the Pittsburgh Steelers, mm-hmm. Green Bay Packers. Because if you have a guy who's worried about his job, that's when he starts making suboptimal decisions. Sorry.
Well, no. And I mean, you're right. And nobody's going to, I mean, Teddy Bridgewater is a good quarterback on a team that's already built on the defensive and the running on the defensive side of the ball and running the ball. And, but they can run the ball. Sure. They have Christian McCaffrey. They have one of the best, if not the best running back in the game, but that defense isn't ready to carry the team. Look at the 49ers this last year. Like, let's be real. Jimmy Garoppolo, well, he had his best year, but he's not a guy that you want to rely on. And we saw it in the Super Bowl to win the Super Bowl. But he did well because that defense was so stacked that he didn't have to necessarily worry about making mistakes and didn't have to necessarily worry about turning over the ball and just do enough to be a game manager as well. And those type of teams, sure, they will win. And that's what Teddy Bridgewater is. But signing him to a 3-year contract when you're not ready to win now was a stupid move by the Panthers.
I think even a question has to be brought up as to whether or not stylistically that's even a fit that makes your team all that much better. Even if your intention is to just hold off the rebuild forever and try to win today. I mean, a lot has been said about Teddy Bridgewater's A-dot compared to the A-dot of his receivers. A lot of data would suggest that the ADOT belongs to the receiver more than it does to the quarterback, and so we may not necessarily be looking at that in the right light. But, I mean, what we've seen throughout Teddy Bridgewater's career is a quarterback that has made his hay when he's been good. The best times he's been good has been as a short passer, as a guy that's looking for the intermediate throws at most. I mean, he's not a guy that's looking to throw more than 15 yards down the field very often. Obviously, DJ Moore kind of fits into that. Stompy and I have also kind of maintained and held that Curtis Samuel probably can be more than what we've seen from him as well so far. I think he has the skill set to be a receiver that plays a little bit closer to the line of scrimmage, but still with the addition of Robbie Anderson, whatever you want to say, you don't know what that target distribution is going to be for him. And Anderson himself seems like a receiver that doesn't necessarily fit with Teddy Bridgewater. So let's assume that the Carolina Panthers are doing the right thing in trying to win right now. Was Teddy Bridgewater over a guy like even Jameis Winston, for example, even the fit that they needed on that team to get to where they want to go?
I mean, I don't know about all that, but I just want to say one more thing. One thing you have to worry about if you're going to take this approach is you can't, you know, be labeled a team that isn't trying to win. It's hard to shake that stink off you, and you know teams aren't going to want to go sign with you. So that is like a legitimate one risk. And Panthers maybe would have been better off signing a Matt Rhule next year after finishing dead last than doing it this year. Or maybe the Jets are smarter than everyone gives them credit for by having the dumbest coach in football employed for another year. You know, finish in last, get a great quarterback, bring in a new, much smarter coach, maybe the offensive coordinator in Baltimore. Who knows?
I just wanted to add on to the Bridgewater point, but I mean, the same goes for like the Colts. I guess I don't really understand that signing, the Philip Rivers signing. I know it's only for a year. And then, but I don't know why you would want to give money to Philip Rivers while Jacoby Brissett is, I think, cheaper. I believe he was cheaper. And it's not like you're going to get this amazing upgrade in QB play there. So I don't think that signing didn't make any sense for that team build. And I don't know if Tom Brady actually makes sense for the Bucks, because their defense was not good last year. Their secondary is atrocious. And maybe it's they recognize that and they think they need more firepower, but I would think that you would get that with Jameis more than Tom Brady. But I don't know. Those two signings just didn't, for where their teams are at, they don't make any sense to me.
I will say that the Bucks.
I think they're both borderline cases enough where if you think it's an upgrade, you can chase that. But I mean, I'm with you in that. I think Rivers is like a pretty decent upgrade, but I don't think. And maybe Brady is too. It's just like Brady is significantly smarter than Jameis Winston, you know, who led the league in interceptions, pick sixes, one sack off of leading in sacks. It's just like stupid, just stupid decision making. Where, you know, having a savvy veteran like Tom Brady, if you fully trust your receiving core and your defense, you know, can get you some more wins. But
I agree with that. I mean, it's like Peyton Manning to Denver, where that defense was ready, or that mm-hmm. offense was built to be firepower, or have a lot of firepower. I mean, obviously it got them to the Super Bowl, and then John Elway did a great job of turning it into a defensive team with a waning or falling off the cliff Peyton Manning and Brock Osweiler. But I mean, I guess when I look at those teams, while the Colts have a good defense, their offense still doesn't look great, even with Phillip Rivers. I mean, T.Y. Hilton, older, did only play in 10 games last season. Yes, Paris Campbell was injured. Marlon Mack was fine. That offensive line is great, but I don't know if that defense is ready. And I definitely know that Tampa Bay's defense isn't ready. And I just don't know if you can really rely, besides like being clutch, really rely on Tom Brady to be able to counteract the defense giving up points.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I think a lot of these signings were, I guess, maybe teams chasing the 1% increase in the probability that they get to the playoffs, or whatever minuscule addition that they made to their team that they think makes them that, you know, one or two wins better. I don't think that any of these blow anything out of the water. We were talking about a GM with a long-term mindset. I mean, it seems to me like, you know, getting a younger asset that maybe can be there for a few years might have been the better way to go. But again, I'm not a GM. I'm just a guy on Twitter that likes to comment on stuff. So here is where we are for now. But let's go on. A 17-game schedule is a thing now. Expanded playoffs are about to be in the NFL. Do we think that we see maybe an increase in injuries based on this? Do you think that we see maybe some players getting actually rested more than we would assume? Do we see not necessarily what happens in basketball with teams or with players sitting full games out just because there's not enough games in the NFL for that to even be a possibility, but do we see players kind of being very measured in their roles because of the potential increase in playing time over the course of the season with the additional games at?
Yeah. So again, this is like the coronavirus thing where I think it's just like small. Like I don't think it's enough to really like move guys up and down your rankings, but I do think it's going to have an impact. It's going to make younger players a little more valuable. We see this where, you know, like Larry Fitzgerald, Emmanuel Sanders, you know, went off the first 4 weeks of the season, and then they just like absolutely worthless. Like Larry Fitzgerald, we're seeing it. Like, all right, he starts to decline week 10, then it's week 8. Last year is like week 4. So and that's a trend that just like it's true for all players. While, you know, rookies, wide receivers specifically, in the second half far outproduce, you know, rookies in the first half. It's like massive. It's like a 60% increase, like way higher than you'd expect. So that matters more. Depth obviously matters more. You know, injuries, there higher injury risk because of that extra game. You're farther removed from a bye week. So running backs, I think, matter less. Like the zero RB strategy has a little bit more credence, as does holding on to your fab. Because again, you know, depth matters. You know, your backups, like you can see like last year we saw it. Like I drafted my girlfriend's team for her, and it was like an absolute juggernaut. It had everyone you could hit a home run on. It had Lamar Jackson, it had Chris Godwin, it had Mark Andrews, it had pretty much everyone. The other team had, you know, Christian McCaffrey, it had Ryan Tannehill, it had Breshad Perriman, it had like a bunch of scrubs off the waiver wire, and it was just like the right week. And you're going to see that a lot. You're going to see like waiver wire heroes, not dramatically more, but just to like slightly higher degree, that extra game, farther removed from like a team that looked really sexy, you know, week 5 winning championships and things like that.
I also think you'd have to believe or think that, like you said, running backs, the zero running back strategy is going to be a lot more prevalent or a lot more successful, because I would think, especially for running backs, that like Eitan said, you would have to kind of give those guys some rest, more rest. You would have more committee running backs. Like, we don't have very many bell cows in this day and age anyway. And I have to believe that would even dwindle a little bit more, and you're going to go by 2 or 3 running back committees at that point.
I think that even extends to wide receiver ones. We've been seeing this for a while. Wide receiver ones are getting less and less usage. They're getting less and less targets because of the, you know, upbringing of dominant slot receivers that we've seen in the game, and just more spreading the ball, more passes to running backs, whether or not those are more efficient is another thing entirely. But we're seeing more and more teams start to fully spread the load. I would assume that gets even more pronounced with potentially a larger load to spread it out. All right, so let's now get into the Dynasty Diagnostic. But really quickly, before we do that, Scott, I know you're working on things all the time. I wanted to ask if there was something maybe we didn't cover that you've been working on that you found interesting that you wanted to kind of talk about a little bit now before we get into the Dynasty Diagnostic itself.
I mean, what could I be working on? I'm unemployed, guys.
I don't think you can. You can stop quote unquote working, but fantasy football is more than work. It's a lifestyle. So I don't think you're ever going to stop actually thinking about fantasy football.
No, that's absolutely right. Just to the people at home, free agency is not dead yet. Probably in the next week or so, I'll tell everyone where my new home's going to be. There's a couple of big name free agents out there too. I think Grant Barfield too. But just keep an eye on that on my Twitter feed.
Perfect. I'm looking forward to it, man. I really am, because I do consume a large amount of your work, and we're actually going to have Graham on the podcast in about a week as well. And I'm sure he'll have something to say to that effect. So let's now get into this week's Dynasty Diagnostic. And it is our episode 62 roster. It was submitted by Fairly Odd Parent of Fantasy. You can find him on Twitter or her at FairlyOdd_FF. Please be sure to give them a follow on Twitter. And if you want to be part of next week's show, all you have to do is follow the podcast at Dino Diagnostic. Smash that subscribe button and leave us a review at the link in the description on iTunes or Podbean. Stompy, do you ever actually put like a link in the description? Have I just been saying that line for months for no reason?
Yeah. Well, I should probably do that, huh?
Here's to hoping there's a link in the description this time.
Probably not. I'll forget.
So that Eitan doesn't just sound like an idiot.
No, you're
more
an idiot.
So than general. All right. So it is a 10-team superflex point per reception. Snoppy doesn't know the starting lineup requirements. So, you know, all this talking about.
Send us all of the information. Good God. Your lineups make a difference on how we evaluate these teams.
All this talking about me being an idiot, maybe it's just water finding its level. Maybe we're perfect for each other, Stompy. Right. Maybe that's what it is. But it is, like I said, a 10-team superflex point per reception, at least. At quarterback, we have Baker Mayfield, Jameis Winston, and Derek Carr. Baker Mayfield is starting this year. Jameis Winston can't seem to find a starting spot. Derek Carr seems to be like a dead man walking at this point. Has a little bit of Andy Dalton in him, although, you know, we don't even really know what the Bengals ultimately are going to do with Dalton. But Baker, Jameis, Carr, for me, definitely another quarterback is needed here. I'd be looking for a cheaper option. We always go back to Matt Stafford because people underrate Matt Stafford. I think Sam Darnold would probably be another decent option for this team. Do you guys think that maybe I'm overthinking this and what we have currently is probably good enough? Is there a specific guy that you had in mind that is going to make this quarterback room a lot more competitive for now and for the foreseeable future? We'll go ahead and we'll start with you, Scott.
Yeah, so this is an interesting team. So just another Warren Buffett quote, just for fun. He talks about the stock market and how there's no called strikes. Basically, you can just you don't have to buy any stocks. No one's forcing you to buy stocks. So you can just wait until you see like the perfect value stock, and then you buy it. And you know, I think the draft can be like that too, where there's certain guys who just, you know, they're in this ADP range, and okay, according to, you know, the ADP I'm looking at, they're one of like the top five values or top three values. Do I draft them? And I just like stay away from them, not because I don't like them, but just because there's a lot of uncertainty there. And I just like don't have a good grasp on the situation. Like I think Diggs is a player like that. Like I like the talent, but I was unsure of him in Minnesota. I'm unsure of him now in Buffalo. I think Baker's kind of like that. Like I was so high on Baker coming out, and then unless he was hurt, I get the offense. I get all the offensive line deteriorating, bad coaching, but he just looked really bad. And there's a few.
You heard it here first. Scott said, "Stop making excuses for Baker Mayfield."
I mean, he's young. We'll see. Yeah, I mean, Odell looks like trash too, but Chark, another one of Boyd. Yeah. So a lot of guys like that, guys who jump out that I do love. At ADP specifically, big Debo fan, big Deontay fan, love Singletary. And just looking at this, like you said, you know, quarterbacks, you know, really jump off. I also don't see this as, you know, I don't think he's likely to be a top three team in his league. At 103, he probably is super flex, probably hope two is there, give him another quarterback, but two is probably not starting for the first half. Maybe you can coast with Carr. I think they probably add someone. I don't think his job's too secure. I don't know. It's just, it looks like one of those middle of the pack teams that looks sort of stuck to me. Chubb and Singletary is starting running backs. Evan Ingram starting tight end. That's fine. Diggs, Chark, Debo, your choice of and Boyd as starting wide receivers, and then Baker and Carr. I mean, right. Isn't that kind of just like he has a bunch of firsts, 103, 4, 6, 9, 10. But I feel like he's hurting for high-end starters more than depth.
No, I absolutely agree. I mean, like you said, Eitan, you basically have one starter at quarterback here, because I don't know where Jameis is going to be a starter at this point in free agency. Derek Carr, I mean, they just brought in Marcus Mariota to probably fight for that job. So Derek Carr could be out of a job very easily too. And how much do you actually trust Baker here?
Let's assume he takes Tua at 103. I think that's going to happen. I think he should definitely.
So yeah, I mean, even if that's the case though, you're probably not, like you said, you're not playing him in his first season. He's probably going on, if this has a taxi squad, he's probably going on your taxi squad regardless. He's not going to be playing.
I wouldn't do that. I think you'd hope Carr maintains the job and is serviceable for the first half, and then Tua, you know, replaces Fitzpatrick or whoever second half. I don't think he's going to be great, but I think he's going to be like Carr levels.
Right. I mean, what do you think about Jameis though? Because I think everybody going into free agency thought he was going to land a starting job, because there were a few starting jobs out there or teams that were looking for a different quarterback. And all of a sudden we find that there's not really a landing spot for him to be a starter. Maybe San Diego, but it doesn't seem like they want to spend the money. And it looks like they'll probably take a quarterback in somebody like Herbert or Tua or,
Here's a question for you, Stompy. Does New England really think that Brian Hoyer
and Jared Stidham,
Kessler are better than Jameis Winston, Cam Newton, Andy Dalton? Or did he think Trevor Lawrence is better? The chance at Trevor Lawrence is better than all of them.
The thing for me is that while that defense is not as good as I think it showed, especially in the first half of the season, it's still, that defense is still good, and it's going to kind of drag them to win a few games. So I would think that somebody like Cam Newton would be a great starter for that defense, where he doesn't,
assuming he's not dead. He just might be.
Well, my concern with Cam Newton is he had that foot injury, and I don't know if that takes away, like, after the years of
2016.
Yeah. I mean, for me, like, a big part of it is his running ability. Like, he's never been a great passer. Last year he was fine, but his ADOT was, or was it 2 years ago, was fine.
Average every year except for one, but that 1 year he was the best player in football.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's got the MVP, but you're not relying on Cam Newton week in, week out with his arm, especially now, because what happened with that shoulder? We still haven't seen him recovered from that shoulder injury because of the foot injury. So you have the shoulder injury, which affects his throwing. You have the foot injury, which affects his running, and the years of abuse as a running quarterback. Does he have anything left? Like you said, is he metaphorically dead? I don't think Scott would suggest he might be just in an alley somewhere. But yeah, I mean, it's tough to take a chance on Cam, because he hasn't, like you said, been healthy since 2016, but we didn't even see him really last year. So we don't even know if he can throw the ball anymore at this point. And if he's got a foot injury and lower leg injury, he might be in trouble on that standpoint. So I wouldn't.
He needs both.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. And so like somebody like Andy Dalton kind of makes sense there because he's not going to be a game winner, but he's going to be a game manager. And definitely better than what they have on their roster. I make a good point. Jameis, do you really think Bill Belichick could take Jameis Winston and his horrendous decision-making? Though he did get LASIK surgery in the offseason. I don't think that affects his brain at any point, but you never know.
If I were the agent of a quarterback, who just threw as many picks as he did, I would make Jameis get LASIK surgery, whether or not he actually needed it.
Yeah.
Just get bionic eyes. Like, forget it. We're moving on to the new thing. But no, I guess kind of to add to that before you kind of go on the full on answer here, Scott, we just as a football community see interceptions as almost more damaging than TDs are positive. Is that an incorrect assertion? Should we be seeing interceptions in the light that we do right now? Are we overvaluing interceptions? And I mean, is the league kind of doing that as well? Or are we kind of just seeing, does that as much as we think directly correlate to wins and losses?
Yeah. So actually I had an interesting thread on this. I get to DM with Adam Harstad. He's one of my friends. He's also like one of the top three smartest people I've ever come across in my entire life. And I know very smart people. And we talked about this, and the way he looks at quarterbacks is you can't have all three of high yards per pass attempt, low interception rate, and low sack rate. You know, think of it as like a three-legged stool where, I don't know. He explained it way better, but anyway,
it's like the fire triangle. You need a fuel, you need an ignition source, and you need oxygen.
Okay. So you're there's a trade-off for one to get the other. And you saw that with Jameis Winston, like very high yards per attempt, very high touchdown rate, but literally worst in the league in interception rate, sack rate, pick six rate. And like when he's throwing these picks too, like you'd expect it. Okay. A quarterback is down by 14 touchdowns. All right. Interception rate goes up as it should. You have to, you know, be more high risk to get those rewards to bring your team back. But yeah. You're up by three and he's like, now's a great time to throw.
Yeah.
So it's just in some cases we can overrate it, but like the way to appropriately rate it is to contrast it to, you know, sack rate, yards per attempt, touchdown percentage, and you know, have a composite and figure out, in his case, egregiously bad in two things and doing those at like the worst possible times, which definitely didn't make up for everything else he brought to the table. But for fantasy, like that's exactly the kind of guy you want. Yeah. And especially too for Chris Godwin and Mike Evans. I think Mike Evans is not going to be as anywhere near as productive with Tom Brady under center.
By the way, they each had only 120 targets apiece. So I can't imagine the efficiency is going to be as good as that this year with Tom Brady. So I wouldn't be selling Godwin per se, unless you're like one of those people, I got to sell at peak value. This is peak value. I would, but Evans, I'm definitely afraid over the next 2 years.
I mean, I think Godwin could be a buy. Like Chris Godwin's offense runs through the slot. Tom Brady's offense runs through the slot. I have him as a first round pick in startups. I mean, before and after the Tom Brady signing. But Mike Evans, I think it was like 38% of his fantasy points came on deep passes last year. Godwin was half that. And then, you know, Jameis Winston threw 50% more deep passes than Tom Brady last year, far more efficient on those deep passes. And just, you know, a more conservative style of offense that's going to hurt Evans. It could help, you know, the check down wide receiver. Goblin.
So here's the ultimate question for me, Scott. Do you think Jameis Winston lands in New England?
I don't know. What I would do is what I outlined. What Belichick might do is he might just, you know, go out there and win 13 games with Brian Hoyer and just like say, fuck you, Tom Brady, fuck you. You're nothing without me. But I know enough to know I don't know what Belichick's gonna do.
Fair enough.
Do we think that he's done for his career, though? Or do we think that maybe he doesn't start this year, but we see something in the future from a guy like Jameis? Just because, I mean, at the end of the day, it takes an unnatural amount of arm talent to be able to do the things Jameis has done, whether good or bad. Do we think that that is just completely outweighed by the lack of decision-making that he's displayed thus far?
No, I think he has an offer from, like, a Pittsburgh Steelers, and he's holding out hope he can find a starting job or a New England, and that's not going to come. And then in a few weeks, he's going to settle for the Pittsburgh Steelers and go be a backup there.
And it's not, I mean, it's not a bad idea. We've had a friend who we're both, Eitan and I are both Broncos fans, and our friend is as well, who suggested that Jameis somewhat makes sense in like Denver, where if Drew Lock isn't the guy that we think he is, or that John Elway thinks he is, and really the fans right now, what do you do? Because that team is kind of built to win right now, and you, if you throw Jameson's there, it's not really a step back by any stretch.
Yeah, I don't hate that.
But GMs, a lot of GMs don't think that way, so it makes sense to us, maybe not to GMs in their pocketbooks.
Also, I mean, kind of just on that pathway there, I think the Jacksonville Jaguars need to think about it as well. Not because they're necessarily built to win, but just because the variance with Jameis is such that, you know, you can be a 10-win team or you can win zero games with Jameis Winston starting at quarterback. So, I mean, you kind of come out ahead either way. But
all of this to be said that you can't really trust Jameis to be a starter this season, and so you really only have one starting quarterback that you can trust.
Absolutely. I love how we circle back to that. All right, so Diggs, Chark, Debo, Curtis Samuel, Deontay Johnson. I heard that you did not mention Mecole Hardman, and it kind of made my heart drop just a little bit. Do you think that Mecole maybe is overhyped at this point? Do we think that the Sammy Watkins situation and not necessarily knowing where that's going to go is kind of holding him back a bit? Or was he just overlooked? Do you like Mecole Hardman as well this year as a dynasty buy?
No, I just missed him. I like Hardman. I also like John Ross at ADP quite a bit. But yeah, I mean, again, he is a very deep team, but I think now's the move to, you know, and with those five first too, I think now's the move to start, you know, trading depth for a quality starter. Maybe you can get, I don't know, who's a sexy quarterback you can go after.
Matt Stafford. Always Matt Stafford.
You got Tannehill pretty cheap these days.
Drew Lock. I love Drew Lock. That's my quarterback this year, by the way, Scott. So get on him.
Oh, boy. I'm not a Lock guy.
Well, you better start being.
It's a lot of data against him, but it's a very, very small sample size.
No, I guess just looking at this team as a whole.
Wentz, maybe?
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, Goff is still relatively cheap right now. Goff was still the top 10 quarterback last season.
I want a Konami code guy. That's what I want.
Jalen Hurts. Do it.
Ooh. I mean, if he is ever a starter, that'd be nice to see, but I don't know if that's happening.
Yeah, well, we said that about Lamar Jackson. I don't know what to tell you, man. But, yeah, I mean – Yeah. Kyler Murray's the obvious one. Dak's too expensive at this point.
I think you might be better off getting Dak than Kyler's a mid round first QB in startups in two QB leagues, which I mean, I love Kyler, but that's too rich for me. But
it's outpacing expectations.
Round four.
Yeah, no, he's probably more two or three at this point. He's top five dynasty.
Went round four in one league. Let's see the other.
Oh, yeah, you could probably get him later than that. Oh, you're talking about Kyler. Sorry.
Round three, round four.
Yeah.
Prescott.
I don't know. Really? Okay. Well, I mean, but you have a valid point there where it's like, yeah, you have these firsts that you don't necessarily need to use to pick up those players. You have a good young talent.
Sorry. Last.
No, you're fine. You're good. But you have the wide receivers to do well. I mean, Dig Shark, Debo Boyd, top four are fantastic. I like Curtis Samuel. Scott apparently doesn't. I do like Deontay Johnson a lot as well. A year two wide receiver going in that put up some decent numbers despite horrendous QB play. Mecole Hardman, Corey Davis. I mean, it's a good wide receiver group. And even the running backs I don't hate, though I don't love the depth on them. So, like, you can use 1.03 and 1.04, even 1.06 in Superflex, and then sell 109, 1010 for a guy that maybe somebody's down on, Kirk Cousins, Matt Stafford, where you get a starting quarterback and you feel a lot better about this team moving forward.
I'm there with you with Matt Stafford. I don't know if I'm there with you with Kirk Cousins this year because of the loss of a guy like Stephon Diggs. But, I mean, again, I think we all kind of have come to the same idea on this team that the depth is there. You don't need to worry about scattershotting pieces at this point. Right now, it's getting the one or two pieces you need to make this team a real competitor. Because if you look at tight end, Evan Engram, Ian Thomas, Blake Jarwin, one of Ian Thomas or Blake Jarwin is likely to be very, very close to a tight end one, maybe a low-end tight end one. Evan Engram, if he can stay healthy, he's a top three tight end most likely. Running backs, Chubb and Singletary. If Singletary can dodge the draft bombs, then there's a very real possibility that he can be a very good player this year. Same thing with Ronald Jones, at least a decently productive RB3. So the depth isn't what you're chasing on this team. You need a quarterback, and you probably need a running back. Outside of that, I think that you should start to compile assets to really get those two and maybe push those picks down the line in trades for 2021 picks plus if you're looking to still maintain this level of flexibility going into next season. But as a whole, I really do think that it's a roster that is not very far from where it needs to be a very competitive team.
I'll also say this, though. I think you need two running backs. And again, those 2020 picks can be valuable trade chips. You don't necessarily need to get a player. So in Superflex, with these 2020 picks, I would probably pick with 1.03 and 1.04, like a quarterback. Tua should be available. And one of those top three running backs, which I think will be starters right away in the NFL, with that, and then even 1.06, you might be able to get somebody like if Swift drops or if Dobbins drops, and there's still some running backs that you can take there that I like. And then I would sell 1.09, 1.10 to either add a running back or add a quarterback. I think you need to go quarterback with one of them, and then you could probably add a running back with 110 as well. So that's the route I would be going with this team. Chubb, Singletary, fine top end, but Singletary, like Eitan mentioned, there is a chance that they draft a running back and put him into a committee. So you need to get at least two more running backs, in my opinion. Not necessarily top end, but and I would have to look at ADP, but somebody like James Conner, I wouldn't hate there as like your RB3. Who else can we? I mean, David Johnson, really, at this point, too, you could probably buy for 110, and I would be fine with that because he seems to have landed a situation where he has more talent. Or where he has more chances to touch the ball. So that's the route I would be going here. Draft a running back, draft a quarterback, draft maybe another running back, and then sell 1.09 and 1.10 for and Evan Engram. Sorry, forgot about the tight ends. We have Evan Engram, Ian Thomas, and Blake Jarwin. I think you can sell Evan Engram to help you obtain a higher-end running back as well.
Yeah, this is a very, very nice car. It's a luxury automobile. You're missing the hood ornament here. I think that's where me and Stompy are kind of coming into agreement here. But thank you so much for submitting this team. It's been a really, really fun team to look at. And like I said, we had an interesting team last week. I think this team is not that far from contention. Just needs a couple of pieces to kind of get it over the line. But that is going to be it for today. Please, please make sure to follow your head technicians. Eitan Alive for myself and FF Stompy for Sam. Scott has been an absolute blast so much during this podcast. Please make sure you're following him at Scott Barrett DFB and look out for what he has going on in the future. And please go to the Dynasty Diagnostic feed on iTunes. Give us a 5-star rating and review. It really helps the podcast grow and reach more listeners. We have a Patreon. We have a store, envy.com, called FF Pod Shirts that you can go to. Look at some of the merchandise that we have. I know that other podcasts like the Superflex Super Show, like Top Shelf DFF, and I'm not sure if I'm even missing some here, but Damn they it. Have merchandise. Trade Addicts, of course, have merchandise on this particular storeenvy.com store. It is presented by Dynasty Outhouse. Dynasty Outhouse is one of the good guys in the fantasy community. Please make sure to both support him in that. And while doing that, you can also support Scott Fish's what was the name
charity of the, charity, but it's Fantasy Cares. So you 10% of all proceeds to Dynasty Outhouse's store goes to Fantasy Cares. So not only are you supporting the podcast you listen to like us, but you're also supporting a great charity that Scott Fish started.
Perfect. So thank you so much for making it to the Dynasty Diagnostic Service Center today. Please be sure to keep up with all your scheduled maintenance and catch us next time to ensure quality performance. See you in the next episode.
Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Tell me what you see. It's the Dynasty now. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Yeah. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Tell me what you see. It's the Dynasty.
Diagnostic popped it. Now your team is the topic. Eitan and Stompy as a team, they're unstoppable. All bold, but no bold. It is rolling a roll that I'm told. Comp a bowl to a cockpit. And I just hope there's no leaks. Yeah. I ain't changed my oil in weeks. Yeah. How'd I get a lot of these stains on my seats? Yeah. Only mechanics that I trust cause it's free. Yeah. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. It's my dynasty team and it's got a couple needs. Is it this? Is it that? Is it picks? Is it bad? Do I even have a chance? Do I got it in the bag? Let me know.
Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Tell me what you see, it's the Dynasty now. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Yeah. Pop the hood, tell me what you see. Tell me what you see, it's the Dynasty.
Diagnostic, gnostic.